That same evening, the telephone in Daniel's Chelsea flat rang. Nobody knew he was back in town. He debated with himself whether to make the effort to answer it, and gave in after the tenth peal. He couldn't ignore such persistence. "Danny, is it really you or that cursed answering machine? I refuse to talk to a robot. Matter of principle." He recognised Michael Hargreaves' voice immediately. "What is it, Mike? Is Wendy okay? Where are you?" "Still in Lusaka, both of us fine, old boy. More than I can say for your pal Ameru, you were right, Danny. News just broken. He's got the axe. Military coup. We've just had a signal from our office in Kahali." "Well, what's happened to Ameru? Who's the new man in power?" "Don't know to both questions. Sorry, Danny, it's all a bit confused still. Should be on the BBC News your end, but I'll ring again tomorrow as soon as I have any more details." That evening it was tucked in at the end of the news on BBC One over a file photograph of President Victor Umeru. Just a bare statement of the coup d'etat in Ubomo and the takeover by a military junta. On the TV screen, Umeru was a craggily handsome man in his late 60s. His hair was a silver fleece, and he was a light-skinned, the colour of old amber. His gaze from the television screen was calm and direct. Then the weather forecast came on, and Daniel was left with a sense of melancholy. He had met Victor Umeru only once, 5 years ago, when the president had granted him an interview covering the dispute with Zaire and Uganda over the fishing rights in Lake Albert. They had spent only an hour together, but Daniel had been impressed by the old man's eloquence and presence, and even more so by his obvious commitment to his people, to all the various tribal groupings that made up his little state, and to the preservation of the forests, savanna, and lakes that were their national heritage. "We see the riches of our lakes and forests as an asset that must be managed for posterity, not something that is to be devoured at a single sitting. We look upon nature's bounty as a renewable resource which all of the people of Ubomo have the right to share, even those generations as yet unborn. That is why we resist the plunder of the lakes by our neighbours," Victor Umeru had told him, and it was wisdom of a kind that Daniel had seldom heard from any other statesman. His heart had gone out to someone who shared his own love and concern for the land that had given them birth. Now Victor Umeru had gone, and Africa would be a poorer, sadder place for his passing. Daniel spent the whole of Monday in the city talking to his bank manager and his agent. It went well, and Daniel was in a far better mood when he returned to the flat at 9:30 that evening. There was another message from Michael on the answering machine. "God, I hate this contraption. Call me when you come in, Danny." It would be 2 hours later in Lusaka, but he took Michael at his word. "Did I get you out of bed, Mike?" "No matter, Danny. Hadn't turned the light off yet. Just one bit of news for you. The new man in Ubomo is Colonel Ephraim Tafari, 42 years old, apparently educated at London School of Economics and University of Budapest. Other than that, nobody knows much about him except that he has already changed his country's name to the People's Democratic Republic of Ubomo. Bad sign. In African socialist speak, democratic usually means tyrannical. There have been reports of executions of members of the former government, but one expects that." "Well, what about Umeru?" Daniel demanded. It was strange how strongly his sympathies inclined towards someone he had known for such a short time, so long ago. "Not specifically mentioned on the butcher's bill, but presumed to be amongst those put to the wall. Let me know if you pick up anything about my friends Chetty Singh or Ning Cheng Gong." "Will do, Danny." Now Daniel put the events in Ubomo out of his mind, and his world shrank down to the space enclosed by the four walls of the cutting room at the studio in Shepherd's Bush. Day after day he sat in the semi-darkness, concentrating his entire being on the small glowing screen of the editing console. In the evenings, dizzy with mental exhaustion and red-eyed with strain, he staggered out into the street and caught a taxi back to the flat, stopping only at Partridge's in Sloane Street to pick up the makings of a sandwich supper. Each morning he awoke in darkness before dawn and was back at the studio long before the daily commuter invasion of the city was underway. He was caught up in an ecstasy of creative endeavour. It heightened his emotional awareness to the point where all of his existence was in those lambent images that flashed before his eyes. The words to describe them bloomed in his mind so that he spoke into the microphone of the recorder with only occasional references to his notes. He relived every moment of the scenes that unfolded before him, to the point where he could smell the hot, dusky, musky perfume of Africa and hear the voices of her people and the cries of her animals ringing in his ears as he worked. So great was Daniel's absorption in the creative process of dubbing and fine-cutting his series that over the weeks that followed the recent events in Africa retreated into the mists of distance. It was only when, with a shock that started his adrenaline flowing, he saw Johnny Inzu's face looking at him out of the small screen and heard his voice speak from beyond the grave that it all rushed back upon him, and he felt his determination grow stronger. Alone in the darkened cutting room, he replied to Johnny's image. "I'm coming back. I haven't forgotten you. They haven't got away with what they did to you. I promise you that, my old friend." By the end of February, 3 months after he had started the editing, he had a rough cut of the first 4 episodes of the series ready to show his agent. Elna Markham had sold his very first production, and they'd been together ever since. He trusted her judgment and stood in awe of her business acumen. She had an uncanny ability to judge to within a dollar just how much the trade would bear, and then to squeeze that very last dollar out of the deal. She wrote a formidable contract which covered every conceivable contingency, and several that fell outside that definition. She had once written a spin-off clause into one of his contracts. He had smiled at it when he read it, but 2 years later it had yielded a wholly unexpected royalty of $50,000 from Japan, a country that hadn't even entered into Daniel's original calculations. At 40 years of age, Elna was tall and willowy, with dark Jewish eyes, and a figure like a Vogue model. Once or twice over the years, they had almost become lovers. The closest they had come to it was 3 years previously, when they had shared a bottle of Dom Perignon in his flat, to celebrate a particularly lucrative sale of subsidiary rights. She had drawn back from the very brink. "You're one of the most attractive men I've ever met, Danny, and I'm sure we'd make tremendous music together, but still you're more valuable to me as a client than as just another good romp." She had buttoned up her blouse and left him to the agonies of sexual frustration. Now they spent the morning in the preview theatre at the studios, watching the first 4 episodes straight through, back to back. Elna made no comment until the last tape was played out. Then she stood up. "I'll take you to lunch," she said. In the taxi, she talked of everything but the production. She took him to Mossiman's, in West Halkin Street. The club that Anton Mossiman had fashioned out of an old church was now a high cathedral of gastronomy. Anton himself, resplendent in his whites and his tall chef's hat, rosy-complexioned as a cherub, came out of his kitchens to chat to them at their table, an honour afforded only to his most favoured members. Daniel was in a fever of anxiety to learn Elna's opinion of his work. But this was an old trick of hers to build up tension and expectation. He played along with her, discussing the menu and chatting unconcernedly about irrelevancies. Only when she ordered a bottle of Corton Charlemagne did he know for certain that she liked it. Then she flashed dark Jewish eyes at him over the rim of the glass and said in that husky, sexy voice, "Marvellous, Armstrong, bloody marvellous, your best yet. I kid you not. I want 4 copies immediately." He laughed with relief. "Oh, you can't sell it yet. It's not finished." "Can't I? You just watch my dust." She showed it to the Italians first. They always favoured his work. The Italians had an historical and emotional interest in Africa, and over the years Italy had proved to be one of Daniel's best markets. He loved the Italians, and they loved him. A week later, Elna brought the draft Italian contract around to his flat. Daniel contributed a plateful of smoked salmon sandwiches and a bottle of champagne to the proceedings, and they sat on the floor, put Beethoven on the CD player, and ate the sandwiches while Elna went over the contract with him. "They liked it as much as I did," she told him. "I've jacked them up 25% on the last advance they gave us." "You're a witch," Daniel told her. "It's black magic." The Italian advance almost covered the entire cost of production of the series. The rest of it would all be profit. The big gamble had paid off handsomely, and he had no backers to share it with. After Elna had taken her commission, it was all his. He tried to estimate what his ultimate payoff would be. Half a million, certainly. Probably a lot more, depending on the Americans. When all the world rights had been sold, it might be as much as $3 million. He had impressed even himself. After 10 years of hard work, he had broken clear. No more overdrafts. No more taking his begging bowl from one arrogant sponsor to another. From now on, he had charge of his own destiny. He had creative and artistic control over his work and the rights to the final cut. In future, it would be the way he wanted it, not the view imposed upon him by his backers. It was a good feeling, a bloody wonderful feeling. "What have you got lined up for the future?" Elna asked, as she helped herself to the last of the smoked salmon. "I haven't thought about it yet," he lied. He always had two or three projects in the warming oven of his mind. "I still have to finish the last two episodes." "I've had a few approaches from interested parties with money to invest. One of the big oil companies wants you to do a series on the South African Apartheid Society and the effect of sanctions on..." "Oh, hell no!" It was marvellous to be able to turn down an offer of work in such a peremptory fashion. "That's all cold porridge and last night's leftovers. The world is changing. Just look at Eastern Europe. Apartheid and sanctions are yesterday's news. They won't even exist by this time next year. I want something fresh and exciting. I've been thinking about the rainforests, not the Brazilian forests. That's been done and overdone. But the African equatorial region, it's one of the very few unknown parts left on this planet. Yet ecologically, it's of vast importance."
"Sounds good. When will you start?"
"My God, you're a hard task, mistress. I haven't even finished the last one, and you're on to me about the next."
"Since Aaron divorced me, somebody has to keep me in the style to which I've grown accustomed.
All the duties of matrimony with none of the privileges and pleasures." He sighed dramatically.
"You still on about that, silly boy? You could talk me into it yet, and you might not like it. Aaron didn't."
"Aaron was a big prick," Daniel said.
"That was part of the trouble," she chuckled, huskily sexy. "He wasn't." Then she changed the subject.
"By the way, what happened between you and Jock? I had a very strange phone call from him. He said you'd had a major punch-up. He implied that you'd blown your mind and gone over the top, nearly got him into all sorts of trouble. He said that you and he would not be working together again. Is that right?"
"Not to put too fine a point in it, yes, that is right. We've come to a parting of the ways."
Pity.
He's done some fantastic work on this Africa Dying series. Do you have a replacement cameraman in mind?"
"I don't, actually. Do you?"
She thought about it for a while. "Would you have any objection to working with a female?"
"I can't think why I should, as long as she can stand the pace. Africa is a raw, rough country. It takes a certain resilience and toughness to cope with the physical emotions and the conditions there."
Elna smiled. "The lady I have in mind is tough enough and talented enough, you have my word on it. She's just done a piece for the BBC on the Arctic and the Inuit Indians, Eskimos to you. It's good, very good."
"I'd like to see it."
"I'll get you a print."
Elna sent the tape round to the studio the next day, but Daniel was so totally involved in his own work that he dropped it into a drawer of his desk. He meant to view it that evening, but instead he let it slide. 3 days after he'd finished the series, the tape was still in his desk, forgotten in the excitement of all the other things which were happening around him. Then Michael Hargreave called from Lusaka again. "Danny, I'm going to send you a bill for these calls, costing HM Government a ruddy fortune.
I'll buy you a case of bubbly the next time I see you."
"You must be in the chips, dear boy, but I'll accept the offer. The good news is that your friend Chetty Singh is out of hospital."
"Are you sure, Mike?" "Good as new. Remarkable recovery, so they tell me. I had our man in Lilongwe check it for me.
Only one arm, but apart from that, Chetty Singh is back in business. You will have to send him another leopard for Christmas. The last one didn't work." Daniel chuckled ruefully.
"Did you hear anything of my other pal?"
"The chink? Sorry, not a dicky bird. Gone home to Daddy and the lucky dragon."
"Well, let me know if he pitches up. I won't be able to leave London for a couple of months at least. It's all happening here."
Daniel was not exaggerating. Elna had just sold the Africa Dying series to Channel 4 for the highest price ever paid for an independent production. They were also breaking their advance planning and screening the first episode at prime time on Sunday evening, 6 weeks from now. "I'm going to throw a viewing party for you on the big night," Elner told him. "Oh, God, Danny, I always knew you were the tops. It's so good to be able to prove it. I've invited people from all the continental and North American stations to watch it. This is going to take them by storm, believe me." The Saturday before the party, she rang Daniel at his flat. "Have you had a chance to look at that tape I sent you?"
"Oh, which one?"
"Oh, which means you haven't," she groaned. "The tape about the Arctic, Arctic Dream, the one shot by that camera woman, Bonnie Moan. Don't be obtuse, Danny." "Damn, I'm sorry, Elner, I just haven't had a chance to get round to it." "Well, I've invited her to the party," she warned him.
"I'll look at it right now, right away," he promised, and went to rescue the tape from his desk drawer.
He had been intending to skip view the tape, but found that he was not able to give it such a cavalier treatment. From the opening sequence, he found himself captivated. It opened with an aerial sequence of the eternal ice of the far north, and the images which followed were striking and unforgettable. There was a particular sequence of a vast herd of barren ground caribou swimming across one of the open leads in the ice. The low yellow sun was behind them, so that when the herd bull rose from the dark water and shook himself, he filled the air around him with a cloud of golden droplets which framed him in a precious nimbus like an animal deity from some pagan religion. Daniel found himself enthralled to the point where his professional judgment was suspended. Only after the tape had run to its conclusion did he attempt to analyze how the camerawoman had achieved her effects. Bonnie Mahoon had understood how to use the extraordinary light to endow it with a texture and mood that reminded him overpoweringly of the luminous and ethereal masterpieces of Turner. If he were ever to work in the gloomy depths of the equatorial forests, that use of available light would be critical. There was no doubt that she had the gift of exploiting it. He looked forward to meeting her. For the viewing party, Elner Markham had hired half a dozen extra television sets and placed them in strategic positions in her flat, including the guest toilet. She was determined that no one should have an excuse for missing the event that they had all assembled to celebrate. As befitted the guest of honour, Daniel arrived half an hour late and had to fight his way in through the front door. Elner's parties were extremely popular, and the large drawing room was bulging at the seams. Fortunately, it was a balmy May evening, and the guests had overflowed onto the terrace overlooking the river.